time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 8th of November 2014. Island Life is Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. I'm Chris Walker, and on Saturday the 8th of November, I talked to Meron Lawler from Direction Matiatia about the Environment Court hearing for a proposed Matiatia marina. And I played interviews and recordings with the Waiheke Youth Board and community development campaigners Jim Dears and Denise Bijou from the Waiheke Local Board Community Engagement Event at Ostend Market on the 1st of November. One of the things which has really been a big thing this week here on the island is the developments in the hearing around the proposed Matiatia Marina, and with the applicant saying that they're going to go into the court and saying yes, they will be putting in a revised application, an application for a marina that excludes a car park and reduces the number of berths. That, of course, has pretty big implications for the hearing, both for the applicant and for those who are opposing it. And I've got Meron Lawler from Direction Matiatia here with us this morning. Good morning, Meron. How are you?
Good morning, Chris. Well, very well.
Good. And I must say as well, we did invite both Graham Guthrie from Waiheke Marinas Limited and their expert Phil Wardell onto the show this morning. And Graham Guthrie declined and no response from Phil. So we did offer them the opportunity to come on as well. So, but we've got Meron here with us now. So, Meron, obviously, there was everyone's fairly aware that there was a bombshell that the applicant, at the last minute, really, the second last day of the hearing, said we're going to significantly change our application. The judge sent everyone away to have a bit of a think about that. And maybe you want to pick up the story with what happened then with the applicant when the court reconvened.
So the applicant dropped the bombshell at about 4:45 on the Thursday evening, the second last day of the hearing, and that bombshell was that in light of the concerns that had been expressed about transport and the reclamation for the car park, that it was withdrawing that from its application. And as you indicated, the judge sent everybody away. The following morning, the court reconvened. The judge directed that no evidence would actually be heard on the final day set for the hearing. And instead, the court gave some indication to the applicant about what its thinking was in relation to the application as it stood. And in summary, what the court said to the applicant was, even by withdrawing the car park, there are still some significant issues. And those issues are very much about the size of the marina in this location. And while the court said it wanted to make very clear to all the parties that it wasn't presupposing a final decision, its thinking was somewhere between an outright denial of the marina as proposed or accepting a significantly smaller marina, and the judge kept stressing the importance of significantly smaller. There was a sort of round of, I guess, legal discussions about the way forward, because even the judge said that he was a little concerned about the lateness of this proposed change to the application. And so it was agreed that the applicant would go away and that it would indicate, it had a week to indicate what it planned to do in light of the comments made by the judge. It came back Monday of last week and said that it intended to proceed with a significantly smaller marina, and that the process now is it will develop the plans for that significantly smaller proposal and will submit those to the court and to the other parties by the 15th of December. And we then have about a week to make a decision as to whether we want to dispute the amendment application. We'll, of course, continue to dispute any marina at Maitiatia, but we have a week to indicate to the court whether we dispute their right to amend the application.
So that's really about whether you consider this to be the same application in amended form or that you believe it should be deemed a new application. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And there are pros and cons to that particular way of approaching it. On the one hand, if we say, well, we think that this is a new application and the court ultimately agrees with that, then we really are back at square one. They will put in an application and that application will then have to go through all of the steps that we've already been through. So on one sort of telling of the story, it doesn't make a lot of sense. What we actually want is a verdict. On the other hand, there is good reason for us to argue that it's an entirely new application, because every issue that we have raised in opposition to the marina has been an issue that the court has favourably commented on from our perspective. So there is a level at which we're also inclined to say, look, let's just proceed and get a verdict in this case.
I mean, surely it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other, because you need to, you know, both sides, or all parties, you know, the council, the applicant, Direction Maitiatia, the other people who are opposing the application, are all going to need to relook at key parts of evidence around, you know, the foreshore, the reclamation, the impact of that on the bay, you know, the whole traffic thing changes. Mm. So, you know, really all of the key issues need to be re-examined, don't they?
That's exactly right. And it will be an interesting aspect of the way that the case unfolds. DMI, for example, let alone Auckland Council, Auckland Transport, other parties have invested a huge amount of money in calling in experts who have considered the current plans in relation to transport and wave attenuation and visual impact, among a whole range of issues. And with any change in the plan, obviously, all of that evidence will have to be re-explored, and we're going to have to engage our experts to again consider the new proposal. So one of the things that we'll certainly be pushing for is that the applicant pay our costs, whatever the outcome is, because our costs have effectively been thrown away by their last-minute decision to change the proposal.
So, also this week, you know, and this was posted on the Direction Maitiatia Facebook page, and you know, I mean it's kind of hard to know how seriously to take this. I mean, no names are given, but there's an accusation there that one of the key players was saying, "Well, look, this is a ploy. We'll do this and then try to vary it once we get consent." I mean. How seriously can we take kind of anonymous accusations like this?
I think that we can take them reasonably seriously. Direction Maitiatia was contacted yesterday by three independent people. They're people who have not been involved in the court case. They're not Section 274 parties. And the three people actually didn't know each other. And each of them contacted us yesterday to indicate that they had overheard a conversation that a person associated with the marina development was having with a range of other people in a public space. And the accusation that all three of them made independent of each other was that that person effectively said, we're really not worried about having to put in an application for a smaller marina without a car park, because we'll simply add that in once we get consent. We'll seek a variation of our consent application. And in reality, if, as Mr. Guthrie had indicated on the day that the bombshell was delivered in court, this was their cunning plan, it actually makes a lot of sense, because legally, once a marina, regardless of the size of it, is in place, it creates in law what's called a permitted baseline. And that permitted baseline then allows a subsequent decision maker to look at what already is approved or exists in that location and say, well, look, adding back in another 20 berths or another 40 berths won't actually make much difference to what already exists in that space. So we had anticipated in within minutes of their announcement that they were withdrawing the car park, that the cunning plan, as it was really to remove from the jurisdiction of the court the decision around a car park, but it didn't actually remove the issue of the car park associated with the marina for all time.
But really, I mean, is this as devious as all that? I mean, you know, any application, that can be the case. And in fact, it seems a fairly standard procedure for building, you know, for building what might be regarded as controversial. If we look at the Faritana Bay building, you know, that's the process. But the process is set out in the appropriate, you know, regulations. That's something which is open to any developer. So it can hardly be a surprise, can it?
No. And in that respect, it wasn't a surprise to us that once they had signalled this was their intention and similarly signalling that they were going to put in for a smaller marina, we certainly saw instantly that what they were choosing to do was to work within the ambit of the legislation in terms of scaling it back with a view to expanding it in the future. I think that the concern in this particular case is that the court has already given some very strong indications that it is concerned about the size of the marina in this location. And one of the reasons for that is that it precludes a range of future uses for that space. In that context, while the applicant is certainly entitled to do what it's doing, and let's be very honest and clear, it's not doing anything illegal. It is conceivable that the cunning notion of it is that it's seeking to remove from the jurisdiction of the court certain decisions in order that once it's got what it wants, which is a permitted baseline, it will then seek to add those things back on, which this court would not have otherwise approved.
So, I mean, obviously the court can only consider what's in front of it, not what might be.
Yes.
And isn't it the case that if the consent is granted and then they do seek a variation, that you have another bite of the cherry as well? You have another opportunity to oppose that variation if it comes up.
That's exactly right. And you know, it is one of the, I guess, the benefits of the legislation. The difficulty is that once the permitted baseline has been established, it makes it much more difficult for any opposition to be mounted to that. In the first place, because the expansion of something that is already in place doesn't necessarily follow the same legal processes, nor even the same public notification processes. So it is conceivable that in the future, if a smaller marina is allowed at Maitiatia, it will be possible for the applicant to expand that without the sort of public consultation or public notification that had to take place for a marina as such.
I suppose another implication or another factor here is that the government proposes to review the Resource Management Act and remove the rights of a number of parties to oppose development or oppose applications. Is there some concern that by splitting this project into parts that, you know, that a future application, you might be precluded from opposing it?
Absolutely. And because the national government has made clear that it intends to change the RMA, and all of the past changes to the RMA over the last 5 years have involved a very gradual decline in the ability of the community to object to developments that it considers inappropriate in a particular place. We fully expect that proposed changes will in fact erode our ability to challenge an expansion of an existing marina. In addition to that, there are also concerns about the additional costs. This community has, despite Mr. Guthrie's assertion in the newspaper this week that there are only 300 supporters or people actually opposed to the marina, this community has raised over $150,000 to date, which is a massive amount of money for a population of 8,000 people. And any future application to extend a proposed smaller marina would necessarily involve further cost to the community. And Mr. Guthrie has again made it clear he doesn't care about that at all.
Yes, it's going to be interesting to see where this all goes now, and interesting to see, you know, the scope of the application that the company bring in on the 15th of December. So we're now looking at something which is heading for a considerable period into 2015, aren't we?
Most definitely.
I imagine courts, you know, have a Christmas break, which is somewhat like their lunchtime and longer than most of us might get.
Absolutely. So the court has indicated already and taken on board the concern that we've raised about the timing of all of this. The court has indicated that while we have to respond by the 22nd of December, that response is simply to indicate whether we object to the redevelopment of the application. But the court has also indicated that it will then schedule the next step in the process, whatever that might be, some considerable time into January or early February, to take account of the fact that Direction Matiatia is coordinating 287 individual parties who will be variously on holidays and running businesses on the island for the summer peak.
All right, so it's very much wait and see. One last question. I was thinking back to the very, very start of this process, when there was the first kind of notification, really, that this was to occur. And one of the battles then was about whether the correct process was to go through, I can't remember what it's called, but, you know, the
hearings commission process.
Whether to go through the commission process or whether to go straight to the court. And the view of the community, I think, probably at the time, was very much weighted towards going through the former process. I mean, in hindsight, looking back now, do you think it was better that it did go directly to the court?
I think that from the perspective of the DMI case, there has been a benefit to it going directly to the court, because it's now before the judge and two hearing commissioners. They've expressed a preliminary view that is certainly not in favour of the marina applicant. And in that respect, that's been a real advantage from our perspective. Otherwise, what we might have faced is the same decision or process having come about as a result of the council-based hearings, and therefore a limited chance for us to object. On the other hand, going directly to the direct referral process has cost the community enormously, because the hearing process before council is really designed to, I guess, wash the evidence and refine the issues in dispute. And in that context, that didn't occur. So it's all occurred within a courtroom environment, which is considerably more expensive.
Yeah, and there has been considerable dispute over the nature of some evidence, say particularly in regard to Māori evidence, hasn't there?
Absolutely. The evidence has, particularly in relation to Māori cultural issues, been starkly different depending upon whether it's for the applicant or for DMI and Ngāti Poa. And that's also the case with things like navigation. We have had, you know, three navigation experts who initially agreed that there was not a single problem with the proposal to build a breakwater in the ferry lane, and a former captain of Fuller's who came in and said, well, actually, I would consider it a problem, and it's okay for a couple of experts to sit in their office and agree that it wouldn't be a problem, but as somebody who sailed in and out several times a day, I think it is a problem. And that's one of the things that the court was particularly concerned about and directed the applicant to reconsider, that it was not appropriate to be building a breakwater in a ferry lane.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Miran. It's Miran Lawler from Direction Mātiatia. And just to reiterate, we did invite Graham Guthrie and Phil Wardale from the applicants for a marina to appear on the show as well, but they declined. So thank you very much, Miran, for coming along today.
Thanks, Chris.
And we look forward to updates.
This is Country Mike, and you're listening to Waiheke Radio.
I'm at the Waiheke Market in Ostend, and this morning the Waiheke Local Board are staging a community engagement event, and here to talk about what that involves is Local Board member Bex Ballard. Good morning, Bex.
Good morning.
So what's involved in a community engagement event? Why are you doing this, and what do you hope to achieve?
Well, we've formed our Local Board plan, which is a result of a lot of community engagement to date, but I guess we just really want to get out there and celebrate with the community that we've made this plan and get some more feedback from people and see what people think about it. The main focus for me here today is we're also launching our youth board. So we've set up a youth board. We had about 19 people apply for 13 places. So we've got 13 kids between 12 and 24 who are all really keen to get out there and make a difference. We're going to be running some events and looking at what we can do to make the island better for young people. So we're about to launch them as part of the plan. So, you know, that's what I'm really excited about today.
So how do you propose to go about incorporating youth into having a say in what happens in the island in a meaningful way?
Well, what we're doing with the youth board is we've got meetings once a month, and they're splitting into portfolios, similar to how we do it on the local board, but instead of them being the same portfolios we have for local board, they've decided what they're interested in. So once we have the launch, they're going to get up and talk about the things that they've decided that they want to focus on. So naturally they're gravitating towards things like music and events, but they're also looking at social issues on the island and culture. Some of them are interested in the environment, so for them, we want to find some real tangible projects, or for them themselves to find some real tangible projects of how they can make a difference.
So does the local board then find itself in the position of having to say no to the initiatives that the youth council bring up? You know, because you have to be the adult and bring the budgetary constraints and the pathway that's been set by the plan and go, nice idea, but no.
I'd hope not. So I go to all the local, all the youth board meetings, so I'm there while they're talking about the ideas, so hopefully if there's anything too out of control, I can rein it in. But we've got events funds, and, you know, I guess there's some parameters we need to set, so, you know, the criteria for our events funds and the amounts, but, you know, it's definitely about enabling them and getting them to think up their own projects, and we want to support them in any way we can.
So what would you like to see happen as a kind of tangible outcome of setting up this youth council? So if we look forward over the next year, what would you look back on and deem as a success?
Them delivering their own projects. So I think, you know, definitely the focus is going to start on events, but also just seeing like that sort of a sense of pride and what it means to be a young person on Waiheke growing. And one idea that I've had, which I haven't run past the board yet, so I'm not sure if they'd be keen on or not, but I think it'd be really cool to do sort of some sort of exhibition where, like an I Am Waiheke exhibition, where we have people do art or write stories or any kind of creative expression, photography, about what makes it great to be a youth on Waiheke, and like really build a pride in what that means. Because you know, I think for youth, they can see some limitations in here, but there's also a lot of amazing advantages living here as well. And I think that, you know, growing a sense of pride in what that means and how lucky they are is a really real valuable thing to do.
Well, thanks very much and good luck with the launch.
Thank you.
Hi there, I'm Matariki Roach and I'm Waiheke Island's Youth Advisory Panel member.
So today, Matariki, you are involved in the launch of a Waiheke Island Youth Council.
Yeah.
So you've got some help on board.
Yeah.
What's that going to mean for you in your role on the wider Auckland Council?
Basically, it means that I have a support group which I can get more opinions and they can get more opinions, and therefore I can give a more educated opinion and advice to the council about youth issues for our area. So basically it means having a stronger voice and a more educated and, I guess, proper voice, I guess, like a real voice for Waiheke youth rather than just like the opinions of my surroundings. So
how have you gone about finding the members of this local panel?
We had applications. So basically we put out the word through Facebook, through Twitter, through Instagram, through schools about Waiheke Youth Voice, and that we were looking for members between the ages of 12 to 24 to be a part of a youth board that would do events and activities and projects and basically make a change for the better for Waiheke young people. So...
And are you happy that you've got a spread of kind of interests and backgrounds?
Yeah, I'm really, really pleased. I was kind of worried that we would have, like, because we have such a concentration of high school students on the island as opposed to like the ages between 18 to 24. I was kind of worried that we wouldn't get as many people through there, but we have four members who are out of school, and then we have a whole heap of two members who are actually 12 years old. So we have a great diversity in age as well as backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, and just generally interests as well. So it's good.
So with a group as diverse as that, there's going to be a huge range in the areas of kind of interest and focus that they want to tend to. How are you going to deal with that?
Well, we have portfolios at the moment, and we're going to speak about that today as well. So we've basically split up into different areas like music, events, self-awareness, what else do we have, infrastructure, like that type of stuff. So we all have different interests, and basically it's a chance for us to focus on the things that we are really passionate about and things we want to change for Waiheke. So it's a great way of using our resources and using our talents as well.
So how will the youth panel function? What's it going to be? What will happen month to month?
So we have monthly meetings that are formal, and we have those at the local board office. And in between, if we have events or projects arising, we'll have more informal meetings, like, say, every 2 weeks or every week if it's getting really close to an event. And basically, they're 4:30 at the local board office up in Onedoa at the moment. And basically, anyone's welcome at the moment. What we want to do is we want to include as many people as possible. So... After a couple of meetings, once we've got the ball rolling, we're aiming to have almost like a public forum where if people have ideas or event suggestions, they can come in. They'll be like, I really want to do this. And we'll be like, awesome, if we like it, and try and make it happen. So that's our ideal of the structure so far. Clearly, we're pretty new to this all, so it's going to be a bit messy for the next couple of months. But
so, I mean, do you anticipate, and I suppose have you found in your involvement you've had to date, that... the youth council comes up with initiatives and then you're constantly being knocked back because you're told there's no money, it doesn't fit in with the plan?
On the youth council in Auckland, we've been quite fortunate because we have MYD, Ministry of Youth Development, who are really, really keen to get as many youth initiatives as possible. So there are different avenues for funding if we want it. Unfortunately, with the new local board as well, they're really, really excited and keen and constantly pushing me to come up with more events and more ideas because they just want so much for our youth, which is amazing, and we're so fortunate to have that. And I know a lot of other local board areas don't have that type of support, so we're clearly very lucky here.
Waiheke Radio.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm Bex from the local board. I'm here this morning with the youth board, if you guys want to come up. So we're really excited about our first youth board on Waiheke. I think as a local board, one of the most valuable things we can be doing is investing in our youth and developing future leadership. So these guys all applied to get into the board. We had 19 people for 13 spaces, and these are our successful applicants. So I worked with Marta on this. So Marta is our youth rep. She's been doing an amazing job being the youth rep to council for the island. And we're really proud of all the amazing work she's done. So I'm going to hand you over to Marta, who's going to introduce everyone on the youth board.
Hi there. So as Beck said, I'm Marta. I'm Waiheke Island's Youth Advisory Panel member for Auckland Council. So we have an amazing youth board here today. And unfortunately, some of them can't be here. So I'm just going to run through the names of people who are here. So we got Sammy, Bella, Josh, Tig, Stella, Tracy, Michaela, Georgie, and Emma. And unfortunately, Justine, Ella, and Isla could not be here today, but they're here in spirit, so it's okay. And David's somewhere in the crowd as well. He's on the youth board too. somewhere. Yeah, so we're so blessed to be able to have a youth board. We are one of the lucky ones who have an amazing local board and community development facilitators who help us out in setting it up. We have an amazing community that supports us, and we just really can't wait till we can get some projects and events off the ground. The way we're set up is we've got portfolios. And so each portfolio is tailored to our specific talents and interests. And so I'm going to pass it on to Stella, who's going to introduce the events portfolio, and she's going to tell you a bit about that.
Hello. Hi, guys. I'm Stella, and I'm going to talk to you about what we're thinking of doing event-wise while we are a part of the Youth Voice. To make events happen, it will take lots of planning from all 13 Youth Voice members, and Kristen, and Bex, and through the help of others. We want to run events based on all our portfolios, and have already thrown some ideas around, such as music, life skills, self-awareness, sports events. We also plan on having events just for fun, outside of our portfolios. These could include things such as summer beach parties, beach sports, to a sausage sizzle. The aim of these events is to provide the island's youth with something to do and just have fun. And I'll pass it on to Tracy.
Woo! I'm here to talk to you about the social awareness portfolio. The social awareness portfolio is something that all members of the Waiheke Youth Voice felt really passionate about. Adolescence is a very confusing time with, you know, bodies changing, hormones raging, and it's often quite difficult to find acceptance not only within our peers but with oneself. Unfortunately, on Waiheke, we have the highest suicide rate per capita of youth. And so we are also lucky on Waiheke that we have such a loving and supporting community, and we as a youth board want to look at creating a more positive and safer environment, and also bringing over organisations from town that specialise in this and offer support and extra training. Next up is Sammy about environmental.
So another one of our portfolios is the environmental one, which will specialise in helping the flora and fauna of Waiheke. Here in Waiheke, we have such a unique and beautiful environment, and I believe that it is important to keep it this way and educate the youth of Waiheke on this topic, since as young people, we are going to feel the impact of having a damaged environment. An important focus point for the environmental portfolio will be the brooders' whales and the protection of them in our Gulf. Hopefully, the environmental portfolio will help these creatures along with many other projects to come in the future. And Josh.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh. I'm in charge of the art part of our portfolio. As an artist, I understand the importance of like self-expression and expressing oneself. We as the youth board look to open doors for young aspiring artists to showcase their abilities, whether it be through music, dance, or painting, or whatever you like to do. One idea that we have is a songwriters club. This would mean that all those who write songs, whether it be professionally or just in your spare time, or even if you're just at home and you just like sing songs that you, you know, make up on the spot, just where people can, like, an opportunity for people to come together and just showcase their things, show their songs without fear of being judged or anything, so they can just sing it and people will just be like, cool, man, that was awesome. Yeah. we hope to allow the talents and the gifts on the island to be exposed and bring the youth together, and so that we can all come together and share in these gifts being showcased. Thank you. All right.
Hi, Hi, I'm Bella, and today I'm in charge of presenting the cultural profile. As you could probably tell, Waiheke has thousands of people coming in and out every day. As you could also tell, a lot of these people originate from many different places around the world and consist of a vast range of nationalities. The cultural profile that we want to advocate for does not just focus on Māori and Pacific Islander people. We want to focus on the cultures that make up Waiheke, which is a lot. Personally, I know the importance of diversity and how it unites us all as a community. One of the main aspects of Waiheke is the amount of diversity there is, and it's great. So that was pretty much just an overall of all the profiles that we have that we want to present, and what we want to do as a group for youth and for the community. And yeah, so that's it. So that's Paul. Here we go.
Come on, let's have another round of applause for this outstanding group of young people.
Hi, this is the Top Twins, and we listen to Waiheke Radio. Bring it on.
Hi, my name's Jim Deers. I'm a community builder from Seattle.
So, Jim, you're here on Waiheke Island to talk with our community here. You're an island resident yourself, but you're on the other side of the world. What's your role here today? What are you hoping to engender?
Well, I think a few things. One is just I've worked in a lot of different capacities. So I've been a neighborhood activist, a community organizer, organizing against local government to hold them accountable. But I've also worked in local government and helping government think about how they could become stronger if they're more democratic and really build on the strengths of the people. And saw themselves as an extension of the people. So I think I bring both perspectives. So what I'm hoping to do today is to really help the local board, which is seems fantastic. The local board seems very community-minded here. Figure out how do we better energize the community around the aspirations of the community. How do we not just hold government accountable, but also what is it communities can do to help implement the local plan that's been put together? There's some great aspects to the plan, some great goals around the environment, around just growing the local economy rather than people having to leave the island to get work. There's some great goals around building community, great goals around community gathering places. And I think those goals can best be carried out by the residents themselves. Government doesn't play a role in building community. Government doesn't create the great places. It's community members who do that. So I hope to share. I'll be sharing some stories from Seattle and all over the world, because now I do work everywhere, and just have a real privilege in that I meet fantastic people doing amazing projects. Kind of inspire people about what's possible when you start focusing on the strengths of your community rather than always focusing on what's going wrong.
So, of course, community isn't homogenous. And one of the challenges is to draw together, I suppose, and on the island around a number of the issues that we have going on at the moment, you have quite diametrically opposed views.
Yep.
How do you deal with that?
Well, I think one of the ways is just what the local plan's doing, which is really trying to figure out what's our vision for the future, because it's easier to unite people around a common vision for the future than to just focus on the current issues that divide. It's about how do you start bringing all these different networks together so it's not just the usual suspects, and I'll be talking about that a lot today, about how do we make sure everybody's part of the process and reach out to all the different ways people are organized on the island, whether that's in sporting groups or in gardening groups or whether that's in youth groups or just the people who hang out and drink beer together. You know, how do we bring all those different networks together to create a common voice and start building those relationships? To me, that's the key. Oftentimes the divisions happen because people don't know each other. They don't feel connected with one another.
And that is a considerable challenge, isn't it, bringing in those divergent groups? Because if you look at the groups we have here today, yeah, we've got, you know, as you might say, the usual suspects, Cycle yeah, Action, the people right. who want the marina, the people who are into car sharing, the environmental that's people. Right.
So we have the same issue where I live on Vashon Island. I tend to find islands have the strongest communities because they have the fewest agencies to do things for communities. And so people just roll up their sleeves and do it themselves. On where I live, we have more associations than we have people. People just roll up their sleeves and do absolutely everything. But we started recognizing that a lot of people weren't part of those associations. There are a lot of people who are left on the margins. So we organize, and oftentimes we've labeled those individuals not by their strengths, but by what they're missing. So we use terms like non-English speaking and disabled and at-risk youth to describe most of our population. And then we wonder why they aren't active in our communities. It's because we've labeled them as clients rather than as citizens. And the basis of citizenship is focusing on their gifts. So on our island, we organized a breakfast called We All Belong. And we invite people from all walks of life to come. And breakfast is a great way to get free breakfast, great way to get people to come. And then we had some visioning about what would a welcoming community look like and how can we help everybody feel valued and connected. And we did open space process. And out of that came 25 different projects initiated by islanders to help reach out to people who were disconnected. So somebody recommended that we have everybody in the island read Breakfast at Sal's, which is a book written by a homeless individual on the island, so we could help better understand where he was coming from. So we had reading groups all over the island. Somebody else said, let's organize a stone soup event. And everybody brought something for the stone soup. But as the story was being shared, we said, what's the economic crisis doing to you and your neighbors? And what could you share with your neighbors to help them get through the crisis? And people said, I'll share my guest cottage. I'll share my garden plot. So we started up. We have a large Spanish-speaking population on the island, not very connected with many of the associations. So we started up an Amigos en Vashon project where Spanish-speaking people are teaching their language to English-speaking people and vice versa and sharing culture with one another. We started a cross-ability program so that in the high school so that students would get out of their clique and connect with other students. Started up time banks to help connect people who are on the margins of the economy with one another and share their skills with each other. So it's really, I think the key part is just lifting off those labels that we put on people and remembering that everybody has gifts to give to our community and that our community can't be whole without everybody's gifts.
So you talked before about moving beyond issues, and I think you know there does tend to be a kind of a reactive you know stance that a lot of people take. You know, it's the marina, it's the marine reserve, it's the cycle ways
or
whatever.
That's right.
So how do you go beyond that? What's the secret to getting people to look, say, I don't know, 10, 20 years out?
Right. I think both are critical. I mean, I think it's really important to fight on issues and to demand social justice, demand accountability on the part of government and corporations. But I think the way to build the strongest communities is to first focus on the strengths and just bring people together around shared interests and create a culture of kind of mutual support. It gets a lot more people engaged. You know, just things, I say some of the key principles are just having fun. That we've made community work too much drudgery. We've made it sort of our cross to bear. We've made it all about meetings. And believe it or not, most people don't gravitate to meetings. Most people gravitate to fun. So we need to lighten up, have a lot more fun, more block parties, more street parties, more ways for people to connect with each other. Second thing is just doing more listening and finding out what people care about. We're often activists are out there pushing their agendas and not doing enough listening about what the people are passionate about. Because if the people own the idea, if it's something they're passionate, they're much more likely to get engaged. It's about starting smaller. So many of the projects here are island-wide. Start, you know, more on a street. You're going to get a lot of people engaged who weren't involved before, because if it's island-wide, they're going to say, hey, somebody else will take care of it, right? All kinds of and people are also feeling very powerless these days. They're just feeling overwhelmed. It's like, what's the use? I can't make a difference. So rather than start with climate change or world peace, for people who aren't feeling powerless, it's probably good just to start with very small issues, very small projects to get people connected, give them a sense of their power. And once they have, you know, if they don't even think they have enough power to make change on their own street, they probably aren't going to work on world peace. So the first thing is to work on small things, give people a sense of what they can do through collective action, and then they're more likely to work on the bigger stuff. And then you're much more prepared when the crisis comes. You know, we know crises are the things that people always rally. I've been doing a lot of work in Christchurch, in Kobe, after the bushfires in Australia. People are at their best after a crisis. But what they keep telling me is, then it's too late. You need to build the relationships before the crisis. And then you're much more resilient.
So when people come together to work on things like that, doing this under the auspices of local government, like is happening here today, is that you get a clash between that passion to do something and the bureaucratic processes of government.
Right. So, again, I work from both sides. So when I was in local government, I really tried to figure out, how do we take down the red tape? Because every city I go to in the world, there's community groups that want to do projects. And they get to council and they're told all the reasons why they can't do it. It's because of liability. It's because of health and safety. It's because of maintenance issues. It's because of union issues. And I find there's a way to say yes to every project. It's just how do you cut through that legitimate red tape and deal with those very real issues? And there are ways to do that. And we figured out how to do that in Seattle, which allowed community groups to do over 5,000 community self-help projects. On the other side with communities, I say, you know, don't always wait for permission. Just do it, you know? We had one neighbor who, in my old neighborhood, who had a berm here, the verge there between the sidewalk and the street that's not much good for anything, grass that's owned by council but has to be maintained by the homeowner. There's a woman there who tore up her verge and put in plants without asking any permission, and put in plants that would attract pollinators, birds and butterflies and bees. And her neighbors got so excited about that, they all started tearing up their verges. And now they have a one-mile-long pollinator pathway that connects a native forest with a university where they don't allow any fertilizer or pesticides. It's bringing back all the pollinators. But it was something that was totally a community initiative. And that's, to me, the strength of focus. That's the power of focusing on the community's strengths. So you don't have to wait for permission. You don't have to wait for a grant. You don't have to wait for council action. You can just take action yourselves. You know, we got people painting murals and intersections to slow down the traffic and create an identity for their community. As it was totally illegal, but it became so popular that now our council permits it. Right? It's. I think too often times we're reticent to take the initiative.
So, I mean, you've been working with Auckland Council on, over a period of time. And what are the things that you've seen? You know, you've come in from an outside perspective, and I suppose there's an irony to someone from outside coming in to help a local community work on their own issues. But from your perspective, what are the issues, the most pressing issues that you see facing people of Auckland?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, you know, with the amalgamation is how do you keep government close to the people and how do you keep it responsive? And that's why I think the local boards play an incredibly valuable role in helping to make that possible. So to me, that's the biggest one. When I talk to the Auckland Council, it's urging them to do three basic principles about how do they better connect with communities. One is how do you get out of those silos? It's the strength of every agency that got a laser-like focus on their expertise, you know, but it makes it absolutely impossible to work with communities. In fact, it's anti-community, where we've got one set of silos for young people and one for old people and one for people with disabilities and one for new immigrants, and you can't build community in silos. Sort of backwards, our communities are having to organize themselves the way the government's organized rather than the government organizing the way the community's organized. So urge them to organize in more of a place-based way, to focus on how the functions come together in a place. And I think Waiaki's a fantastic way to do that. And, you know, the local board is a great vehicle for helping to make that happen. Second thing is, instead of always focusing on our neighborhoods as places with great needs to be addressed by council, recognize there's a lot of things best done by community, and to take down some of those barriers and make it possible for the community to do what communities do best. And then the third thing is, instead of always pushing the agenda top down, to being open to supporting community-driven initiatives, that too often times council is just out there doing consultation around council's priorities, and through council processes and programs, where council still has all the power. and then they wonder why they just see the usual suspects. They've worn everybody else down. You know, people don't see any results from their participation. So it's about how do we move beyond consultation to community empowerment? How do we empower communities to work on their own priorities through their own associations? How do we make democracy work again? I think, you know, it's not just in Auckland, it's all over the world. Our democracy is in huge trouble. You know, fewer and fewer people voting, people thinking themselves as ratepayers rather than as citizens. And government has forgotten that government isn't just about the physical infrastructure. It should also be about the democratic infrastructure and about building the social community.
So the other element, of course, is, you know, you've got the people, you've got the government, but you've got business. And then there would many who say, look, the way for a community to prosper, for a location to prosper, is to open things up and allow businesses to, and the market to drive that forward. And I mean, I suppose that, you know, everything you've talked about so far has been about citizens, been about government. But what about that business element?
Well, I don't believe that the market forces have done too well by our communities. I think I'm a very strong proponent of community-based economic development. How do we grow our local economy around the strengths of the people in the place? That too oftentimes the solution around economic development is giving tax breaks to major corporations to come in. It's not sustainable. The profits leave the community. How do we really build our economy around the strengths of the people in place? And I think that's a great opportunity here in Waikiki to kind of demonstrate how that can be done around local food, around arts and culture, around all the innovation of the people here. And the entrepreneurship. I think Waikiki's a leader and could do even more in that regard.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Jim. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Great to be here. Right, yeah.
Waikiki Radio, your local radio station.
Kia ora, my name's Denise Bijou. I work with Inspiring Communities and I manage the Auckland activities, I suppose, as well as working with organisations and communities all over the country, people who are interested in locally led change and sustainability.
So tell us a little bit about Inspiring Communities, the organisation, you know, what you do, what your objectives are.
Sure. Inspiring Communities was started in 2008 when a group of people noticed that the communities in New Zealand that thrived through good times and bad were where people, community people, business people, people who lived, worked, played in places, made decisions and acted on those, as well as just acting on other people's decisions. So they were actively involved in democracy. And Inspiring Communities was set up as a learning organisation to see what was happening in those communities, to see what was working in those communities and for who, because often people have different perspectives on that, and actually the difference they were making as well. So working out ways that we could document some of this stuff so we could share it with others so people didn't have to reinvent the wheel.
So what kind of models or examples can you bring to an island like a community like Waiheke Island when we're trying to move forward?
I think one of the really, there's a number of different models, I think. Most of them are international, but we've seen them used here. We have a book that has most of those models in them. One is really useful, comes out of Canada from the health sector there, called Constellation Governance, which is essentially, instead of trying to get everyone on the same waka, trying to get people in their different waka aligned to the same kind of goal. So you might take the Senate group and go over the big waves or around the bays. Someone else might want to go direct, someone might go fast or slow. That's all fine, because actually variation is what a community is about, and that's how a community is resilient. So that's a great model for governance or organisational design, I suppose. So that's one of the models. There are others as well we can talk about.
So, I mean, I suppose these things are easy to say and harder to do. And what tends to happen is, and we see this on the island, is that you get quite divergent opinions around issues. While there might be some agreement on vision, people who can claim the same vision often have very, very different views on specific steps or issues along the way.
I think that's okay. For the large part, that's how communities are. We're not all the same. It's about learning what you want to hold tight to and what you're much more loose about. And usually the vision, the what, the where we're going is held reasonably tight. We want a cleaner environment. We want less septic tank waste on our beaches. Whatever it is, it can be really big. We just want this place to be a better place for children. Could be a really big goal. It might be safer roads or something like that. The looseness is how you get there. Now, you could have somebody painting or chalking new crosswalks because they want better pedestrian crossings, or people going through the processes with the local board, there are many ways to get to a goal, and I think that's a really good thing to encourage.
So how do you go about, I suppose, you know, there's a fear that some have expressed that you get the usual suspects, you get the same people who have got the energy, the time, the resourcing and the commitment to an issue, and they kind of come to the fore, whereas there's a lot of people who perhaps don't have the background or the resources or the wherewithal to put forward what they believe is important.
That's a really good point. I think one of the first things is to move away from issues and look at what the opportunities are. People get much more attractive to positive change than negative change, even though the negative, the accident or the waste on the beach, it might be what galvanise people. They can be quite, dare I say, passive-aggressive about that, someone else's fault. When you give them an opportunity, particularly if it's got a beginning and an end, like come to the market and help on the stall, something like that, people get involved in those sorts of things. I don't think anyone is apathetic about these things. People often don't know how to get involved, or they think they're going to be sentenced, as Jim would say, to a lifetime of meetings, and they don't want to do that. They'd be much happier to come and sell some raffle tickets or whatever is much more a smaller activity, and then they might not get involved in bigger things. But starting small, doing something visible, making people feel good, tends to give them a sense that they do have some power in this situation. Otherwise people feel powerless, and it's too big and I've got other things to do, you know, and so they don't come.
People often talk of consensus, but that the aspirations of the people in the community can sometimes be at odds. You know, especially when you're working with limited resources. You know, for example, you get people who say, "Well, look, we need to focus more on the arts," and others who go, "We need to focus more on sports and activity." And there's not, you know, you're working with a limited pool of resources or money. It's sometimes difficult to accommodate all those needs, though, isn't it? So, what kind of experiences have you seen where people have worked through that successfully?
I think the most successful examples of that is consensus is a lovely thing, but you can talk until you're blue in the face. If you do something like an open space, or people are prepared to stand up and champion something and other people join them, that is where the energy is, and that's where you start. There's always bright or brighter spots, and that can risk having the usual suspects, so you have to be careful about going to where other people are and including them too in that process. But usually if someone is prepared to start something or be involved in something and champion that, and there are other people there, that's where you'll get a bulk of the population. You'll never get everybody to make a difference with the limited resources you have. And I think the other thing is being really iterative. Don't be attached to some really long-term thing all the time. Do little things as you go. Allow it to go off on tangents, and you'll tend to bring other people along that way as well. There's no easy answer, though.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.